as they used to think it might have been. You're listening to Diffusion Science Radio. Send email to diffusion@2scr.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network, into Sydney on 2SCR 107.3, and over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. Mick Cavazzini, tell us the latest from the world of cloud scientists.
So recently I spoke to Scott Peake, who works for Australian Rain Technologies. Now, he's not a witch doctor or a rain dancer. They are carrying out field trials on a cloud seeding technology, which, if it works, could obviously benefit the Australian farming industry, hydroelectric industries immensely. He told me that at any time there's 10 times more water in the atmosphere than there is on Earth, but you don't always know if it's going to fall as rain. So the theory works like this. Clouds form as fine water droplets get bigger and bigger by the process of collision coalescence until they're so fat and heavy that they fall as rain. Since the 60s, lab trials have shown that you can help this process along with the help of ionized particles. In some cases, even today, they fly planes spraying silver iodide through the clouds. And in the Snowy Mountains, they've been testing a scheme for 7 years now that involves burning silver iodide on the ground and it lifts up into potential snow clouds. But both of these techniques only work for clouds that live below freezing temperature. So I'll let Scott describe their slightly more elegant and versatile solution that also works on warm, humid clouds.
The method that we've been experimenting and trialling is an electrical method. So when you have two small cloud droplets, if you can charge one of those droplets or get enough charge on one of those droplets, there is an electrostatic attraction between the two droplets. And the way we do that is we have a technology which is ground-based, and it's basically a big series of wire, and you charge you pass a very high voltage through those wires. And once you exceed some threshold, these wires form what is known as a corona discharge, which is basically spinning off a free electron. This will immediately charge any naturally occurring aerosols that are passing through that iron plume or through those wires. And when these now charged particles are swept up into the cloud by turbulence and convection, they form the centres of cloud droplets. So when water condenses onto these charged particles, they form charged droplets. And we hope that these charged droplets, as I said before, are more efficient or more effective at growing to the size of raindrops because of that electrostatic attraction to other drops. And now, the charge on these aerosols doesn't have an infinite lifetime. It probably only has a lifetime of 10 to 30 minutes in terms, because as these charged particles are going through the atmosphere, they're also colliding with other particles of opposite charge, and so they may get neutralised. They may also, as I said before, run into a tree or something else that will neutralise that particle. But we place the systems in areas and in topography where the airflow over the topography aids the transport of these charged particles up into the cloud. So, for example, in our trials in Adelaide, we put the systems on the top of an escarpment coming straight off the ocean, so that there is a lot of directing of the airflow upwards up this escarpment and up into the clouds, and so that when we measured the vertical winds there, any particles that do go through the wires are quite quickly transported up into the cloud base.
So let's go into these field trials, and as you say, the principles of cloud seeding are relatively well understood, but the demonstration in the field is a bit of a hassle. Now, your trials in around 2008 in Queensland were rather inconclusive, but more recently in South Australia, you've had some success. There's been a demonstration of possibly 10 to 15% of increased rainfall as a result of the Atlant device. What was different between these trials? Was there a specific design, specific topography that was changed?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the first trials, they were over a fairly short period, but we used the traditional, I guess, statistical method for evaluating these types of experiments, which is analogous to how you would conduct a clinical trial or an agricultural trial or something, where you choose a control area with a number of rain gauges in it, and you choose a target area where you're attempting to make it rain. And then over the course of the the trial, you randomly operate your system, and then at the end of the trial, you compare the rainfall in each of the two areas, and hopefully there's an increased rainfall in your target area. The problem with that is that there's just so much variation and variability in the atmosphere, in weather in general, and not only across time but across space. I mean, if you you know, it can be raining here in Sydney, but you go 20 k's to a different suburb and it's not raining, and that sort of variability is just immense. And so that means any control area you choose is not really representative of your target area. So it makes those comparisons really difficult. And that sort of variability that you need to deal with has plagued weather modification trials over the last 4 or 5 decades. And it's been really difficult to achieve, you know, conclusive statistical results, or at least repeatable conclusive results.
There was some description in the study about comparing downwind regions, which are supposed to be affected by the device, compared to upwind areas. But as you say, you can't really tell that it was or wasn't going to rain anyway. Is that the problem?
Well, that's what that is the problem. Is when you get a result that says it was increased rainfall, then, you know, people will always say, well, it would have rained anyway. And so you need to get a good measure of what rain would have occurred had you not been operating. And using long-term averages or area averages, it's really difficult to get a accurate measurement of that figure. So what we did, we looked at other disciplines, and we got some statisticians, some very clever statisticians from the University of Wollongong, to look at other means of doing this. And over the last decade, there's been huge developments in spatial statistics, which looks at variation in observations over space as well as time. And so they've developed statistical models which would allow us to model what rainfall would have occurred in your target area had you not been operating. And then obviously we can make a comparison to what rainfall did occur and get some sort of estimate of any increase or decrease in rainfall that might be attributable to the operation of the technology. And so over the past 3 years, we've done a number of trials, and in each trial we've increased the complexity of those models and the complexity of the design of the trials, until we've just completed a trial last year in 2010, where again recorded roughly a 9% increase in rainfall.
And over how many days does it take to run this trial to average out the results for a convincing result?
Well, our trials have been run, I think the last one ran for about 5 months, which is fairly short when you consider timescales in the atmosphere. And, you know, using traditional double ratio statistics, I think the World Meteorological Organization recommends you run trials upwards of 10 to 20 years, which obviously is not very cost effective when you're trying to decide whether to invest in these technologies or whether to apply them, or whether they actually work. But with these new statistical techniques, it appears that we can reduce that time frame down to something more meaningful, like 6 months or a year.
So we're talking about very small effects and very powerful statistics to demonstrate them. Mm. What would be the limitations in where you could use this thing? Do you have to? I imagine you have to have a substantial amount of moisture in the air to begin with.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's not going to work everywhere. You can't take it out the back of Alice Springs in June and in a clear day and hope to make clouds. You can't make clouds out of blue sky. I mean, that's a bit of a misconception about the technology or about cloud seeding in general. So you do need certain amount of certain types of clouds. Generally for this technology, we're looking at warm clouds, so clouds with a certain vertical extent below the freezing level, and a certain amount of instability. But fortunately, those clouds occur in lots of places in Australia. And certainly what we're looking forward to now is, after we've finished our trials in Adelaide, we're now looking for partners and collaborators to conduct trials in other areas in Australia, to do just that, to evaluate the technology now under different cloud types and different weather systems to see see how it performs there.
So that's an interesting example there of a technology that's been proven in the lab, but that's a lot harder to test in the field.
And I was quite interested there in the use of negative ions. I can remember as a kid there were negative ion generators, which to this day you can still buy, but they're not as popular, where the theory was that negative ions in the air would actually improve your health in some way. Mm. I remember mine basically charged up all the soot in the air, and then it got attracted to either the little paper collector or to the ceiling or to the walls. So better there than in my lungs, but I don't think the negative ions helped.
So it reduced airway irritation.
It did.
I mean, that shows right there that obviously you can charge particles. They're very quickly earthed. They're drawn to the earth. And the interesting thing was Scott told me that a majority of the ions obviously generated by this device are earthed, but those few that can collect onto aerosols will flood up into the clouds. And even if the lifetime, the decay is only 30 minutes or so, that might well be long enough to get up into a spot where they can seed some clouds.
Well, certainly with the negative ion generators, you could feel the breeze of the negative ions being electrostatically forced away from the emitters, so there would be a breeze going up.
And of course, if proven to be reliable in the further trials, as Scott says, it'll be interesting to see how it's taken up in practice, whether it can only be funded by a government enlarged applications, or whether groups of farmers might get together and decide they need a bit of rain downwind. But then, can you always get farmers to agree on which crops do need rain and which ones don't at the time?
Mm. And when you've actually created the clouds and they're travelling because they're clouds, they don't stay in one spot, how do you actually sort of govern who gets to own the rain, I suppose?
Who owns the clouds?
Who owns the clouds? Who owns the rain? I thought it's fascinating how you said right at the beginning there's 10 times as much water in our atmosphere as there is liquid water on the surface of the planet. And that's an astounding amount of water there that we have the potential to tap when we need it. And yet...
Water on tap?
Well, not necessarily tap, precipitate when we need it. And yet... in Australia particularly, we have areas which are subject to the most horrible droughts. We've just come out of a drought recently, haven't we?
Of course, what you're saying earlier about who owns the clouds, for countries that are not an island continent like Australia, that's actually a pretty huge political issue, because if you seed the clouds over here and you get the precipitation, then the rain doesn't fall on the other side of the border because you've got it first. So you can literally steal the rain.
That's right. If the New South Wales farmers start pinching the moisture out of the clouds on their way to Queensland, who knows what it might happen.
We don't want to go there. And that's all from us this time on Diffusion. You can send email to diffusion@2ser.com. That's diffusion@2ser.com. And tell us your thoughts, feelings and stories. If you'd like to be on radio and you live in Sydney, we need more volunteers on Diffusion. Subscribe to our podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com. Contributing to the program were Patrick Ruby, Mick Cavazzini, and Therese Chen. I produce Diffusion in the studios of 2SER in Sydney, and Diffusion is broadcast nationally via the Community Radio Network. I'm Ian Wolfe. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Looking at the URL, the first thing that sticks out is the colon. And how about a slashing or cutting sound for the slashes? To complete the experience, we might throw in the HTTP and maybe some kind of download sound. www.diffusionradio.com. Lachlan Watmore on guitar.
Radio.